spend a hideous amount of money on them, and then they have an obligation to buy your stuff. Piece of cake. No, that was the job. No, that's what I was gonna get. And so, and I was called Mr. Chlamydia for a while
because you were.
No, it's not for the reason you think.
Nobody had that job, did they? They were creating a job.
No. I was a replacing another guy.
Really?
There's a product manager.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was a huge asset.
Okay.
It made probably $100 million a year. It was gonna be $100 million a year product line that we had. Yeah, and so, when I was here. For Abbott, one of the things I did, so initially for clinical chemistry, and that at that time, we were competing against Hitachi and Toshiba, and that we were doing very well in clinical chemistry in the United States, where I was, and I thought I could come in here and just, you know, kick ass and take names. But I got over here, and after 6 months of traveling out with guys in the field, talking to customers, look what's going on, I went back to my boss, Jay Johnson, if Jay's out there listening somewhere, but I went back to my boss and I thought he was going to fire me. And I said, Jay, I don't think under any circumstances that we're going to be able to compete here in Japan with the Spectrum was the instrument we were selling. And, you know, if everybody's going Hitachi and Toshiba, just there's no way that we're going to be able to be competitive here. And so I think, well, there goes my job, right? That's what I was sent over for. And so I ended up getting another Asia position out of Japan. And at that time, HIV was brand new. And a lot of sexual transmitted diseases were brand new. Here comes a chlamydia link, right? Mm-hmm. And so Abbott just got a contract with the WHO. And we had to start labs all over Asia. And so that's what I did. And that, because I was technical, I had the credentials, and that I was good at that. It was basically setting up labs and teaching people how to use it for the HIV, and also we were doing chlamydia at that time too, and other diseases. So it took me through Australia, Thailand, Malaysia, China.
So you went here the whole time? Then wait, hold on. I thought you stayed in Japan the full time when you came
back. I did, but I was based in Japan.
Oh, you were based here, but you're traveling everywhere. How much time in a year did you get in Japan then?
I was in hotels. You know how your visa,
yes,
or your taxes, you got to figure out?
Right.
I know at that time, 1 year, it was 168 days in hotels.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was, but as a young man, it
was
cool.
Exciting.
I couldn't do it now.
The beginning was first.
Yeah.
The beginning is really exciting.
It was. Wow. I remember waking up and being like in Pakistan or India, and I wake up in the hotel and I wouldn't remember what country I was in.
Yeah.
Again, as a great young man's thing, you know, I was just what, you know, 30 some years old then. Right. So,
and had you started family yet? Had you already? Started
oh yeah,
family?
Yeah. Yeah, two kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So, where were you living in Tokyo? Were you living right in?
No, we were. I was kind of low man in the totem pole, and so they gave me a housing allowance, like Gojumayan at that time. And I tell you what, that during the bubble period, you couldn't touch, you couldn't get anything from Gojumayan.
No.
And that, so we ended up going out to Setagaya.
Okay.
And got a place out there near Yoga. And that, but it was good for the kids because they were going to Seisen.
Right.
Yeah. And so, but that's where we ended up. And then I again moved to Tokyo after I started CGI.
Right.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to start CGI, first of all?
It was chlamydia. You know? When I got that job for chlamydia, when I left Chicago, I was thinking, okay, I'll got this up. I'll do chlamydia for a while. And, you know, I was on the airplane back, and I was thinking, you know, Japan, this is, you know, 1990. And thinking, man, we didn't know it though. Yeah,
I thought we did in 1990. By that time, we knew.
But still, we didn't know it. I mean, that we were still.
I mean,
there was crazy here.
People were saying "fukeiki."
Yeah,
and I told my wife when they stopped saying it, that's when it's hit.
Yeah, well,
the cab driver.
All I know is, you go out there to get home. If you got a cab, you'd pay him 10 times what the cab fare was, and also at that time, the entertainment because. Sales back then in Japan were easy. And basically, you know, you go out to get a doctor, convince them over all your competitors to take them out to the most expensive dinner and the most expensive bar in town, spend a hideous amount of money on them, and then they have an obligation to buy your stuff. Piece of cake. The problem was getting the doctors to pick you over another vendor.
Right.
And that was my job, because being a white guy, the token white guy in the company, because I was the only guy of my kind of, you know, younger guy there, the sales guys figured that out. They started dragging me around to them, with them. And so I spent another part of my job was, you know, just going out. And it's amazing my liver made it. We'd go out, and a lot of times I couldn't get home because of the trains were done, the taxis, end up sleeping under my desk in Morty building, and get up in the morning and brush my teeth and start it all over again.
Yeah. Everyone thought that was so glamorous.
Yeah, really glamorous.
Tell me about it. So after you left Abbott, then you decided to start your own company.
Did they help you in any way?
Did they help you?
I mean, they did help me in a way. One of my side jobs, because I did a lot of things at Abbott, one of them is that we had the U.S. military bases around Japan. And that because of the FDA, because of all of these regulatory issues that they had, they needed somebody that knew about that stuff. And so I was actually tasked with helping them out. And the other thing is we had Guam, which was the Guam Naval Hospital and Anderson Air Force Base out there. And so I was, part of my job was to actually help these guys out. And I realized that they were in real trouble. I mean, just trying to get stuff over here, trying to get people trained, all this other stuff. And so when I left, the very first business I had was to take care of the U.S. military bases. So I went to my then boss and I said, you know, if you, and his name is Mel Schatz, by the way. Thanks, Mel. He was the president of Abbott at that time. And I said, you know, I'm going to be leaving, and these customers are big customers. They need help. How about I do the same thing I was doing before, but you guys will just pay me a percentage on sales. And, you know, he bit, and he said, you know, it makes sense. You know, I don't want to do it. I don't have anybody else that can do it. And so that was really our first business. And it wasn't huge, because I was only making a very small sliver of the sales.
I know now if I would have given him
a bigger number, he would have said yes.
Right.
But I just gave him the lowest number possible. So
you're thinking, worried about, you didn't know.
I wanted to be, yeah. And so that was the very first business. And that business, by the way, still exists. We're still doing it.
Have you gotten a bigger number eventually?
Got a bigger number. I got other guys taking care of it. We've got Guam. We have a distribution business out in the Pacific Islands, and I think we're pretty much the biggest distributor of diagnostic products out there now.
So when you first started your company, how many people were in it when you first started?
One.
That was you?
That's me, yeah.
What are you today?
28.
28.
Yeah.
And that means a lot, because today, one person means a whole lot. You remember, I was a member of the American Chamber. Are you still a member of ACCJ?
You know, I quit this year.
I was a member. And I was on the independent, it was called the Small Business Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one that changed the name, because I was doing the scanner business.
Mm-hmm.
It was just me and my assistant. I didn't need a lot. I was making more than anybody in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we need to change the name of the small business to independent business.
Mm-hmm.
Because being small doesn't mean you're not making a lot
of
money.
Right.
But that's what it implied before, because you remember people would ask when we first came to Japan, how many people in your company? Whenever you gave them a name card, and that's how they judged if you were a big or small company.
Right. And that people did not respect small companies.
They did not respect, but they started respecting mine.
Yeah.
Because I was the one.
Well, no, the ACCJ, I kind of flippantly said that I just quit, but it's I've been a member. I was a member. I was actually representing Abbott back then, so I was a member a long time. So back, it's been 30-some years.
I would have stayed, because, I mean, it's a good organization. There's no doubt about it. And you meet a lot of good people. It's how you it depends on how much effort you're willing to put in.
Yeah.
Is how much you're going to get out.
For 10 years, I mean, I started out as the chairman of the Diagnostics Committee. Then I was the chairman of the Diagnostics and Medical Device Committee. Then I was the founding chairman of the Healthcare Committee. And so ACCJ was a huge you know, in terms of networking, getting to know people,
being
able. I mean, when I was the chairman even of the medical device committee, you know, I had the phone number, and he'd answer his phone of the Minister of Health, Kanzan, and he'd answer my calls, and we, you know, and I is, you know, again, is young and gutsy too, and I wasn't afraid to approach anybody. But I tell you what, having the impetus of the ACCJ behind you, at least back then, it had a lot of clout.
2003, weren't you over the medical committee in 2003?
I was.
That's what I thought, because you were under me during that time. That's when I was president.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you have to remember that time.
Yeah, of course. So, but that's actually about the time we had a, you know, been in business for 3 decades, and we've had good times, and we've had bad times. Good times are better. And that we had a real, it's actually amazing we survived it back in 2001, 2002, 2003. That was actually a very tough time for me.
What happened then for you?
I had, because we, to go back a little bit, we ended up, so the distribution business is actually a very small part of our business now. And we got our main area of success was in helping Japanese clinical laboratories gain global accreditation and certification and quality management systems. So we had 100% market share of all of the large reference labs. And so we were really riding high up until like 1999, so about being in business about 9 years. And so I got the idea in 1999, because we didn't have anywhere to grow. And so I said, well, we can't, no more laboratories we can go to, so let's grow out to different areas. And I looked at it, and I said, you know, the one area that the medical system and we as a society are really in desperate need for is infection control. And that, so I had this crazy idea to create a new infection control accreditation program, which is called IC2001. We got the Infection Control Society of the US, a company called SHEA, which is all the physicians, infection control people. We had Dr. Takaku, who was the president of the Japanese Medical Association at that time. And we had all these, you know, we had AIG involved, we got Merrill Lynch involved, we got all these companies involved, end up raising a lot of money basically launch this infection control program that we would go to hospitals, we would go to public health centers, we'd help them create pandemic plans, we'd help them create these for internal infection control plans, and we had it all built out. And then things I really hit a lot of snags. By the way, this is not only going to be Japanese, this is going to be global. We actually worked with TUV, the accreditation body out of Germany, and that we were going to actually, this is going to be a global infection control program where we would essentially give people all of the tools, and then they would implement these infection control programs, and then we would basically inspect them to make sure that they were in compliance with these programs. Then they would get a certificate from TUV. So that was essentially the business. And, you know, it's just the stupidest little things. There's a doctor named Dr. Kobayashi from NTT Hospital. We were in this like 3 years. Nobody ever mentioned his name to me. But it turns out he was the de facto head of infection control assigned by Kodosho, by the Ministry of Health and Welfare. And I was riding so high. I was like the Icarus, like being next to the sun kind of thing. Right. And so we were at a big meeting at the U.S. Embassy, and a lady, the nurse Ko, came up to me, and she says, "Where's Dr. Kobayashi?" And we had like U.S. Embassy people with us. We had 30, 40 people there at this huge kind of kickoff meeting for IC2001. I said, "Who's Dr. Kobayashi?" I said, "Oh, God, you got to get Dr. Kobayashi involved in this." So I went, and the next day, or the day after, I went to visit him at the hospital, and he was, because it got in the newspaper.
He was livid.
Oh, pissed off. And pissed off, and I didn't, you know, and I just basically, this guy, the way he was talking to me. And
so you didn't realize his power.
I just basically, exactly. I was polite, but I walked out the door. And that was the kiss of death, man. That was a kiss of death. And so so then we had this high powered board. Again, we had people from Johnson & Johnson, from Soccer Defined Technical, from Merrill Lynch, from AIG, from Galen Partners for the head financing. So we had this board meeting, and this is October 10th, 2001, and I basically told everybody, this is the situation. Because at that time, I mean, there's clearly, he was not only going to not support us, but he was going to use every lever of power he had to make sure we never
get off the ground.
Yeah. And so
I did not know this yet.
No, December, I basically, so I had a new plan.
Wait, so, did you know this already, that he was going to do this?
Oh, he was doing it.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
Okay. So he'd already started.
People weren't answering my calls anymore.
They didn't want to be around you.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you became,
Yeah. And so, leopard. You know.
They didn't want to be around you.
Yeah. And so at that time, we had like 40 some employees. And that so we had a board meeting. And I basically told the board, you know, this is the situation, but don't worry, I have a new plan. I look back at the new plan. It was stupid. They were right. I was reaching for straws. Anyway, the new plan was kind of made a shift globally without, you know, taking advantage of our base, and it was very pie in the sky. And one of the board members, and by the way, Ambassador Foley was on my board at that time.
Foley,
yeah, Tom Foley was on my board. Yeah. He's from Spokane, by the way.
Okay.
So. And he was just wonderful. I'm glad he was there. But we had one of the investors from the UK, and he just flipped out, yelling, screaming. We had this board dinner where he tried to throw a chair through a window. So, he was our keystone investor. So he's got,
he had too much. He saw his whole career being thrown out the window.
Well, he was old, so probably not. But
yeah, but still, he was being hurt.
No, it was bad. It was, and so, but we still had, you know, $15-16 million in the bank. And so we basically, I tried to get him together, try to calm things down. We agreed to go back, regardless of what Dr. Kobayashi was doing, and go back to the original plan, even though I think I just didn't have much confidence in it. But what happened really is my goal at that point was just to appease the investors. And that, you know, once you have management team, that's your focus and not the business. And so, yeah, the whole thing, we basically imploded to just a couple of people. and at that time, that's when I wrote that book. I guess sitting up here.
What's the book?
The Boxer Gate.
The Boxer Gate.
That's probably the only thing I'll be remembered for.
Okay, because that was about that situation.
No, it's a science fiction.
Okay,
and I needed to think about something else. It was emotionally and
visited. How many years did this encompass?
I basically didn't draw a salary for about 4 years, so I really had to start doing gigs, and that I became the president of Gibbon Imaging, which is the pill camera. And the Israeli company.
Israel.
Yeah, I did that for a while. I also was the on the board of Cardinal Health, which that was a great gig. And we had a number of other things that I was doing, and I actually made pretty good money, but I wasn't making any over CGI. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And so at the end of the day, they basically wanted what money they had back. It's called redemption,
right.
You know, the redemption rules.
Yes.
And we were through the redemption time. So I basically gave them everything. They started a company with that called Cure Medics. It's still operating in Tokyo. And that basically I had to kind of start over in about 2006, 2007. Mm. And that started a magazine called In Vitro Diagnostics Global News, which is still going. And now we're the largest magazine in that area in Japan. And we're supported by the Japan Society of Laboratory Medicine and Japan Pathology Society. Mm. And that the other thing that happened is I mentioned that we had 100% market share in reference laboratories. Japan government decided that hospital laboratories also need to get accreditation. And so all of a sudden, my worry was we had no other market to go to because we had 100%. Mm-hmm. So that market just opened up. And the other thing that happens, I decided, you know, rather than doing consulting, because consulting is hard. You got to recruit good people. You got to train them. You got to maintain them. And you got to, at the end of the day, you got smart people. They're going to do it their way and not your way, which always pisses me off. So I decided, hey, you know, I'm going to do a software. And that's about the time when the cloud broke out. And we had experience from initial working with software, the stuff that you saw. Right. And that way, by the way, is infection control. Mm-hmm. We were going to be all of the documents.
That was part of that.
That's right. All the documents and everything we were providing were not paper.
You were excited.
Oh, yeah.
You were excited, man.
I was.
And I said, this is going to be big. Because you showed it to me. And you showed it to me kind of like this. You know, the Tom and Jerry thing where you just show me a little bit, but you wouldn't show me all of it.
Yeah. Well, that was before Apple. That was like that was probably 97, 96, 97. Yeah. And we went to Taiwan and we sourced these tablets. Right. And they were really cool. So we had the thing called Web Education. And that it was a CD-ROM that was linked to the web where you could do kind of a funky test.
Right.
So, yeah, we did a lot of cool stuff back then. Mm. But in any case, so our business, we got the software going. We got Roche Diagnostic, the biggest diagnostic company in the world now. They came on so we sold it under the Roche brand. Now we sell it under, Roche is still selling it, Abbott Laboratories is selling it, and Siemens is now selling it globally. And so we've got Leap, it's called Leap Software, and it essentially takes the process we did for consulting. Mm-hmm. And it's a SaaS-based product, a software as a service, and takes the customer through the entire process of gaining the standards for accreditation and then helps them maintain it long-term. And so it's got a really nice annuity business with it. And we have now about 400 customers.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to bring yourself out of that. But I mean, would you say that during that time, did you ever find yourself being really, like they'd say, clinically depressed?
Not really. I you know, it's funny. I remember when I finally decided that the gig was up, the first thing I did was went out here and bought a surfboard. Then I decided to become a surfer.
Okay.
And my first time with the surfboard, I almost died and said, that's not a good idea anymore. I got out, there's all these people surfing out there, and it was pretty high waves. I got my board out in the garage.
I saw it. Yeah. It's up in the roof, right?
It's over on the side of the garage.
And
I went out, anyway. I went out in the wrong area, and the next thing I know, these great big waves started coming in. I'm getting closer to these rocks and closer to these rocks. And
the coral, isn't it? Coral?
No, just these. There's a big pier they built out, and there's the rocks that the pier was sitting on. And the next thing I know, I'm right on the rocks. I'm hanging onto the damn things. And the surfboard's onto my foot, and it's flipping around in the air. And this toothless fisherman came up and saved me after being there for about 10 minutes. He cast down his fishing pole, and I crawled up and pulled my ass out there. And my surfboard's been next to the garage ever since. Yeah.
So you never felt like you were really saddened because of the situation? I mean, you were saddened, but you were never depressed.
Oh, it was. The big hardest part was all the employees.
Right,
they're my friends.
Let them go, right?
Oh yeah, that was really tough.
And you're up to 45 at the time of your peak.
That was 40, 42, I think 41 was a big October meeting. I was 41, but again, I wrote you know, The Boxer Gate. I've written 5 books altogether now. Mm-hmm. All those paintings you saw, I painted.
Right.
If you look at the dates, they're all within that period.
Is that right? How you keep yourself sane, basically?
I guess. Yeah. And, you know, I basically did a lot of work around here, building decks and you know, the little gig thing that I had where, you know, making decent money. Right. And I just figured that was going to go on for a long time. And, yeah, it was all fine. Looking back at it, and, yeah, I just got to have the faith that everything's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have to call him? Was your father alive during that time?
He was. In fact, he came here a lot. And my mom had passed away, and my dad used to come in the summers. And
did you sit down and talk with him a lot about it, or did you ever get?
He knew about it. He knew about it. Yeah, he wasn't worried.
Yeah, he didn't worry at all. Yeah. That helped to keep you calm, I would think.
I suppose.
In a way. Yeah. My goodness. Yeah. That's so. Did it affect your family any?
That was horrible. That was tough. Very.
That's
tough
where you
time.
Took it out most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I didn't take it out on anybody.
Okay.
Yeah. If anything, I just got quiet. Yeah. And I'm a you know a rugged tough rugged individualist tough cowboy type. So
okay.
You know.
Right. Minus the cigarettes and stuff. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, let me ask this before I end the podcast, Mark. I usually ask people this one question.
Okay.
If you could go back in time, and meet the younger Mark.
Hmm.
And give him advice based upon where you are now. What advice would you give him, and how old would he be?
You know, again, the in my adult life, my kid's life, it was the judo was the big trigger that changed the trajectory of my life. And I say that my younger life, my older life, would have definitely been during the IMA. The company's name was IMA, Integrated Medical Advancement. During the IMA time, is that once I figured out that things were going south, would to sit people down and not hang on and to basically step away. Because I just held on too long. I was so emotionally invested. And when things are going as badly as they were, there really wasn't a rational way out of it. At that point, you need to make a rational decision and not just try to put your nose to the ground and just hope to hell it works, right? And that would have fundamentally changed my life trajectory. But then on the other hand, it all turned out pretty good.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much, Mark.
Hey, thank you, Lance.
It was
good.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I want to thank all of you for watching this podcast or listening to it. And remember, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.